he saw the blood. "I did not mean to cut." Wulfgar came over him in a rush, swinging wildly and calling out to Tempus, his god of battle. Drizzt sidestepped the first strike. It took out a fair-sized chunk from the stone wall beside him and stepped forward toward the warhammer, locking his arm around it to hold it in place. Wulfgar let go of the weapon with one hand, grabbed Drizzt by the front of the tunic, and easily lifted him from the floor. The muscles on the barbarian's bare arm bulged as he pressed his arm straight ahead, crushing the drow against the wall. Drizzt could not believe the huge man's strength. He felt as if he would be pushed right through the stone and into the next chamber. At least he hoped there was a next chamber. He kicked with one leg. Wulfgar ducked back, thinking the kick aimed for his face, but Drizzt hooked the leg over the barbarian's stiffened arm inside the elbow. Using the leg for leverage, Drizzt slammed his hand against the outside of Wulfgar's wrist, bending the arm and freeing him from the wall. He punched out with his scimitar hilt as he fell, connecting solidly on Wulfgar's nose, and let go his lock on the barbarian's warhammer. Wulfgar's snarl sounded inhuman. He took up the hammer for a strike, but Drizzt had dropped to the floor by then. The drow rolled onto his back, planted his feet against the wall, and kicked out, slipping right between Wulfgar's widespread legs. Drizzt's foot snapped up once, stinging the barbarian's groin, and then, when he was behind Wulfgar, snapped both feet straight out, kicking the barbarian behind the knees. Wulfgar's legs buckled, and one of his knees slammed into the wall. Drizzt used the momentum to roll again. He came back to his feet and leaped, grabbing the overbalanced Wulfgar by the back of his hair and tugging hard, toppling the man like a cut tree. Wulfgar groaned and rolled, trying to get up, but Drizzt's scimitars came whipping in, hilts leading to connect heavily on the big man's jaw. Wulfgar laughed and slowly rose. Drizzt backed away. "You are not the teacher," Wulfgar said again. But the line of blood-filled spittle rolling from the edge of his torn mouth weakened the claim considerably. "What is this about?" Drizzt demanded. "Speak it now." Aegis Fang came hurling at him end over end. Drizzt dove to the floor, narrowly avoiding the deadly hit. He winced when he heard the hammer hit the wall, no doubt blasting a clean hole in the stone. He was up again, amazingly, by the time the charging barbarian got anywhere near him. Drizzt ducked under the lumbering man's reach, spun and kicked Wulfgar in the rump. Wulfgar roared and spun about, only to get hit again in the face with the flat of Drizzt's blade. This time the line of blood was not so thin. As stubborn as any dwarf, Wulfgar launched another roundhouse punch. "Your rage defeats you," Drizzt remarked, as he easily avoided the blow. He couldn't believe that Wulfgar, so finely trained in the art, and it was an art, of battle, had lost his composure. Wulfgar growled and swung again, but recoiled immediately, for this time Drizzt put Twinkle, or more particularly, put Twinkle's razor-edged blade, in line to catch the blow. Wulfgar retracted the swing too late and clutched his bloodied hand. "I know your hammer will return to your grasp," Drizzt said. And Wulfgar seemed almost surprised, as though he had forgotten the magical enchantment of his own weapon. "Would you like to have fingers remaining so you might catch it?" On cue, Aegis Fang came into the barbarian's grasp. Drizzt, stunned by the ridiculous tirade and tired of this whole episode, slipped his scimitars back into their sheaths. He stood barely 4 feet from the barbarian, well within Wulfgar's reach, with his hands out wide, defenseless. Somewhere in the fight, when he had realized this was no game, perhaps, the gleam had flown from his lavender eyes. Wulfgar remained very still for a long moment and closed his eyes. To Drizzt, it seemed as if he was fighting some inner battle. He smiled, then opened his eyes and let the head of his mighty warhammer dip to the floor.
"My friend," he said to Drizzt, "my teacher, it is good you have returned."
Wulfgar's hand reached out toward Drizzt's shoulder. His fist balled suddenly and shot for Drizzt's face. Drizzt spun, hooked Wulfgar's arm with his own, and pulled along the path of the barbarian's own momentum, sending Wulfgar headlong. Wulfgar got his other hand up in time to grab the drow, though, and took Drizzt along for the tumble. They came up together, propped side by side against the wall, and shared a heartfelt laugh. For the first time since before the meeting in the dining hall, it seemed to Drizzt that he had his old fighting companion beside him again. Drizzt left soon after, not mentioning Catti Bree again. Not until he could sort out what exactly had just happened in the room. Drizzt at least understood the barbarian's confusion about the young woman. Wulfgar had come from a tribe dominated by men, where women spoke only when they were told to speak, and did as their masters, the males, bade. It appeared as if, now that he and Catti Bree were to be wed, Wulfgar was finding it difficult to shake off the lessons of his youth. The thought disturbed Drizzt more than a little. He now understood the sadness he had detected in Catti Bree out on the trails beyond the dwarven complex. He understood, too, Wulfgar's mounting folly. If the stubborn barbarian tried to quench the fires within Catti Bree, he would take from her everything that had brought him to her in the first place, everything that he loved, that Drizzt, too, loved in the young woman. Drizzt dismissed that notion summarily. He had looked into her knowing blue eyes for a decade, had seen Catti Bree turn her stubborn father in submissive circles. Neither Wulfgar, nor Drizzt, nor the gods themselves could quench the fires in Catti Bree's eyes. Chapter 3. Parley. The eighth king of Mithril Hall, leading his four friends and 200 dwarf soldiers, was more appropriately arrayed for battle than for parley. Brunner wore his battered one-horned helmet, the other horn having long ago been broken away, and a fine suit of Mithril armor, vertical lines of the silvery metal running the length of his stout torso and glittering in the torchlight. His shield bore the foaming mug standard of Clan Battlehammer in solid gold, and his customary axe, showing the nicks of 1,000 battle kills, and a fair number of them goblins, was ready in a loop on his belt within easy reach. Wulfgar, in a suit of natural hide, a wolf's head set in front of his great chest, walked behind the dwarf with Aegis Fang, his warhammer, angled out across the crook of his elbow in front of him. Catti Bree, Talmaril over her shoulder, walked beside him, but the two said little, and the tension between them was obvious. Drizzt flanked the dwarf king on his right, Regis scampering to keep up beside him, and Guinevar, the sleek, proud panther, muscles rippling with every stride, moved to the right of the two, darting off into the shadows whenever the low and uneven corridor widened. Many of the dwarves marching behind the five friends carried torches, and the flickering light created monster-like shadows, keeping the companions on their guard. Not that they were likely to be surprised marching beside Drizzt and Guinevar. The dark elf's black panther companion was all too adept at leading the way. And nothing would care to surprise this group. The whole of the force was bedecked for battle with great sturdy helms and armor and fine weapons. Every one of the dwarves carried a hammer or axe for distant shots, and another nasty weapon in case any enemies got in close. Four dwarves in a line near the middle of the contingent supported a great wooden beam across their stocky shoulders. Others near them carried huge, circular slabs of stone with a center cut out. Heavy rope, long notched poles, chains, and sheets of pliable metal all were evident among this section of the brigade as the tools for a goblin toy, as Brunner had explained to his non-dwarven companions' curious expressions. In looking at the heavy pieces, Drizzt could well imagine how much fun the goblins would get from this particular contraption. At an intersection where a wide passage ran to their right, they found a pile of giant bones, with two great skulls sitting atop it, each of them large enough for the halfling to crawl completely into.
"Ettin,"
Brunner explained, for it was he, as a beardless lad, who had felled the monsters. At the next intersection they met up with General Dagna and the lead force, another 300 battle-hardened dwarves.
Parley set, Dagna explained. Goblins are down 1,000 feet in a wide chamber.
You'll be flanking? Brunner asked him.
Aye, but so are the goblins, the commander explained. 400 of the things if there's a one. I sent Cobbel and his 300 on a wide course around the backside of the room to cut off any escape.
Brunner nodded. The worst they could expect was roughly even odds, and Brunner would put any one of his dwarves against 5 of the goblin scum.
I'm going straight in with 100, the dwarf king explained. 100 are going to the right with the toy, and the left's for yourself. Don't ye let me down if I'm needing ye.
Dagna's chuckle reflected supreme confidence, but then his expression turned abruptly grave.
Should it be yourself doing the talking? He asked Brunner. I'm not for trusting goblins. Oh, they've got a trick for me, or I'm a bearded gnome, Brunner replied. But this goblin crew ain't seen the likes of dwarves in hundreds of years, unless I miss me guess, and they're sure to think less of us than they should.
They exchanged a heavy handshake, and Dagna stormed off, the hard boots of his 300 soldiers echoing through the corridors like the rumbling of a gathering thunderstorm. Stealth was never a dwarven strong point, Drizzt remarked dryly. Regis let his stare linger for many moments on the departing host's crack formations, then turned the other way to regard the other group bearing the beam, stone discs, and other items.
If you've not got the belly for it,
Brunner began, interpreting the halfling's interest as fear.
I am here, aren't I?
Regis came back sharply, rudely actually, and the uncustomary edge to his voice made his friends regard him curiously. But then, in a peculiarly Regis-like movement, the halfling straightened his belt under his prominent paunch, squared his shoulders, and looked away. The others managed to laugh at Regis's expense, but Drizzt continued to stare at him curiously. Regis was indeed here, but why he had come the drow did not know. To say that Regis was not fond of battle was as much an understatement as to say that the halfling was not fond of missing meals. A few minutes later, the 100 soldiers remaining behind their king entered the appointed chamber, coming in through a large archway onto a raised section of stone, several feet up from the wide floor of the huge main area, wherein stood the goblin host. Drizzt noted with more than passing curiosity that this particular raised section held no stalagmite mounds, which seemed to be common throughout the rest of the chamber. Many stalactites leered down from the not-too-high ceiling above Drizzt's head. Why hadn't their drippings left the commonplace stone mounds? Drizzt and Guinevar moved to one side, out of the range of the torches, which the drow, with his exceptional vision, did not need. Slipping into the shadows of a grouping of low-hanging stalactites, the two seemed to disappear. So did Regis, not far behind Drizzt.
Gave up the high ground before we ever started, Brunner whispered to Wulfgar and Catibri. You'd think even goblins would be smarter than that.
That notion gave the dwarf pause, and he glanced around to the edges of the raised section, taking note that this slab of stone had been worked with tools to fit into this section of the cavern. His dark eyes narrowed with suspicion as Brunner looked to the area where Drizzt had disappeared.
I'm thinking that it's a good thing we're up high for the parley,
Brunner said too loudly. Drizzt understood.
The whole section is trapped,
Regis, right behind the drow, remarked. Drizzt nearly jumped, amazed that the halfling had gotten so close to him and wondering what magical item Regis carried to make his movement so silent. Following the halfling's leading gaze, Drizzt regarded the nearest edge of the platform and a pillar half out from under the stone, a slender stalagmite that had been recently decapitated.
A good hit would bring it down, Regis reasoned.
Stay here,
Drizzt instructed, agreeing with the crafty halfling's estimate. Perhaps the goblins had spent some time in preparing this battlefield. Drizzt moved out into view of the dwarfs, gave Brunner some signals to indicate that he would check it out, then slipped away, Guinevar moving parallel to him not far to the side. All the dwarves had entered the chamber by then, with Brunner cautiously keeping them back, lined end to end against the back edge of the semicircular platform. Brunner, with Wulfgar and Catti Bree flanking him, came out a few steps to regard the goblin host. There were well over 100, maybe 200 of the smelly things in the darker area of the chamber, judging from the many sets of red shining eyes staring back at the dwarf.
"We came to talk,"
Brunner called out in the guttural goblin tongue.
"As agreed."
"Talk,"
came a goblin reply, surprisingly in the common tongue.
"What will dwarves is offer to Garyak and his thousands?"
"Thousands," Wulfgar remarked.
"Goblins cannot count beyond their own fingers," Catti Bree reminded him.
"Get on your toes," Brunner whispered to them both. "This group's looking for a fight. I can smell it."
Wulfgar gave Catti Bree a positively superior look, but his juvenile bluster was gone, for the young woman was paying him no heed. Drizzt slipped from shadow to shadow, around boulders, and finally over the lip of the raised platform. As he and Regis had expected, this section, supported along its front end by several shortened stalagmite pillars, was not a solid piece, but a worked slab propped in place. And as expected, the goblins planned to drop the front end of the platform and spill the dwarves. Great iron wedges had been driven partway through the front supporting line of pillars, waiting for a hammer to drive them through. It was no goblin poised underneath the stone to spring the trap, however, but another two-headed giant, an Ettin. Even lying flat, it was nearly as tall as Drizzt. He guessed it would tower at least 12 feet high if it ever got upright. Its arms, as thick as the drow's chest, were bare. It held a great spiked club in either hand, and its two huge heads stared at each other, apparently holding a conversation. Drizzt didn't know whether the goblins intended to honestly parley, dropping the stone slab only if the dwarves made move to attack. But with the appearance of the dangerous giant, he wasn't willing to take any chances. Using the cover of the farthest pillar, he rolled under the lip and disappeared into the blackness behind and to the side of the waiting giant. When a cat's green eyes stared back at Drizzt from across the breadth of the prone giant, he knew that Gwenevar too had moved silently into position. A torch went up among the goblin ranks, and three of the 4-foot-tall, yellow-skinned creatures ambled forward.
"Well?"
Brunner grumbled, already tired of this meeting.
"Which one of ye dogs is Garyak?"
"Garyak back with others,"
the tallest of the group answered, looking over his sloping shoulder to the main host.
"A sure sign there's to be trouble,"
Catti Bree muttered, unobtrusively slipping her great bow from her shoulder.
"When the leader's safely back, the goblins mean to fight."
"Go tell your Garyak that we don't have to kill ye,"
Brunner said firmly.
"Me name's Brunner Battlehammer."
"Battlehammer,"
the goblin spat, apparently recognizing the name.
"Use his king dwarf."
Brunner's lips did not move as he mumbled to his companions.
"Be ready."
Catti Bree's hand came to rest on the quiver at her side. Brunner nodded.
"King!"
the goblin hooted, looking back to the monster host and pointing excitedly Brunner's way. The ready dwarves understood the cue for the onslaught faster than the stupid goblins, and the next calls from the chamber were dwarven battle cries. Drizzt took the call to action faster than the dim-witted Ettin. The creature swung its clubs back, then yelped in pain and surprise as the 600-pound panther clamped onto one wrist and a wickedly edged scimitar drove into its armpit on the other side. The monster's huge heads turned outward in a weird, synchronous movement, one to regard Drizzt, one toward Gwenevar. Before the Ettin ever knew what was happening, Drizzt's second scimitar slashed across its bulging eyes. The giant tried to squirm about to get to the stinging elf, but the agile Drizzt slipped under its arm and came in hard and fast at the monster's vulnerable heads. Across the way, Gwenevar dug teeth into flesh and set claws into stone, holding fast the monster's arm.
"Drizzt got him!"
Brunner reasoned when the floor bucked beneath him. With the failure of the simple, if not clever, trap, the goblins had indeed surrendered the favorable high ground. The stupid creatures hooted and whooped, and came on anyway, launching crude spears, most of which never reached their targets. More effective was the dwarven response. Catty Bree led it, putting the Heartseeker up in an instant and loosing a magical, silver-shafted arrow that seemed to trail lightning in its deadly flight. It blasted a clean, smoking hole through one goblin, did likewise to a second farther back, and drove into the chest of a third. All three dropped to the floor. 100 dwarves roared and charged forward, heaving axes and warhammers into the charging goblin throng. Catty Bree fired again and then again, and with just the 3 shots, her kill count was up to 8. Now it was her turn to give Wulfgar a superior stare, and the barbarian, humbled, promptly looked away. The floor bucked wildly. Brunner heard the roars of the wounded giant beneath him. "Down!" the dwarf king commanded above the sudden roar of battle. The ferocious dwarves needed little encouragement, for the leading goblins were close to the platform by then. Out came living dwarven missiles, crushing into the goblin flanks, flailing away with fists and boots and weapons before they even stopped bouncing. A supporting pillar cracked in half as the Ettin inadvertently struck it, trying to bring its club around to get it drizzed. Down came the platform, pinning the stupid beast. Drizzt, crouched safely below the level of the giant's girth, could not believe how badly the goblins and the Ettin had thought out their plan.
"How did you ever mean to get out of here?" he asked, though, of course, the Ettin could not understand him. Drizzt shook his head, almost in pity. Then his scimitars went to work on the monster's face and throat. A moment later, Guinevar sprung onto the other head, claws raking deep gouges. In mere seconds, the ranger and his feline companion sprinted out from under the low-riding platform, their business finished. Knowing that his unique talents could be of better use in other ways, Drizzt avoided the wild melee of battle and moved to the side along the cavern wall. A 12 corridors led into this main chamber, he could see, and goblins were pouring in through nearly every one. Of more concern were the unexpected allies of the goblin forces, though, for, to Drizzt's surprise, he noticed several more gigantic Ettins standing still and quiet behind stalagmites, waiting for the moment when they might join the fray. Catty Bree, still on the platform and firing into the goblin horde, was the first to spot Drizzt, halfway up a stalagmite mound to the left-hand side of the cavern and motioning back for her and Wulfgar. A goblin came up out of the fighting mass and charged the young woman, but Wulfgar stepped in front of her and wailed on it with his great hammer, sending it flying 12 feet over the edge. The barbarian spun about as fast as he could, trying to ready a defense, for another goblin had come up to the side, closing with a spear point leading the way. It nearly got the spear in for a strike, but its head exploded under the impact of a silver-streaking arrow. "Drizzt is needing us," Catty Bree explained, and she led the barbarian to their left along the tilting platform, Wulfgar running along the edge and pounding any goblins that tried to scramble up. When they were clear of the main fighting, Drizzt motioned for Catty Bree to hold her position and for Wulfgar to come forward cautiously. "He has found some giants," Regis, hidden below the pair, explained to them, "behind those mounds." Drizzt leaped down around the stalagmite, then came diving back out, turning defensive somersaults with an Ettin in close pursuit, twin clubs ready to squash the drow. The giant jerked upright when Catty Bree's arrow thudded into its chest, scorching the filthy animal hide it wore. A second arrow knocked it off balance, then Wulfgar's hurled hammer, flying to the barbarian's resounding cries of "Tempest!" blasted the creature away. Guinevar, still on the side of the mound, leaped atop the second Ettin as it came barreling out, muscled claws raking viciously, blinding both the monster's heads until Drizzt got in close enough to put his scimitars to work. The next giant came around the other side of the mound, but Catty Bree was ready for it, and arrow after arrow slammed it, spun it around, and finally dropped it dead to the ground. Wulfgar charged forward, catching his magical warhammer back in his grasp. Drizzt had finished with the giant by the time the barbarian caught up to him, and the dark elf joined his friend as they met the next of the charging monsters side by side. "Like old times," Drizzt remarked. He didn't wait for an answer, but dove into a roll in front of Wulfgar.
Both of them winced, blinded for an instant, as Catty Bree's next arrow sliced between them, slamming into the nearest giant's belly.
"She did that to make a point, you know," Drizzt remarked,
and he didn't wait for an answer, but dove into a roll in front of Wolfgar. Understanding Drizzt's diversionary tactics, the barbarian heaved Aegis Fang right over the rolling form, and the Ettin, stooping for a hit at Drizzt, caught the warhammer squarely on the side of one head. The other head remained alive, but dazed and disoriented, for the split second it took to take control of the entire body. A split second was far too long when dealing with Drizzt O'Erden. The agile drow came up in a leap, easily avoiding a lumbering swing, and sent his scimitars in a crossing swipe that drew two parallel lines across the giant's throat. The Ettin dropped both its clubs and clutched at the mortal wound. An arrow blew it to the ground. Two more Ettins remained behind the mound, but they, all four heads, had seen quite enough of the fighting companions. Out a side tunnel the beasts went, right into Dagna's rambling force. One wounded Ettin stumbled back into the main chamber, a dozen hurled hammers bouncing off its stooped back for every lumbering step it took. Before Drizzt, Wolfgar, or even Catty Bree with her bow could make a move at the beast, a multitude of dwarves rushed out of the tunnel and leaped upon it, bore it to the ground, and hacked and pounded away with battle-crazed abandon. Drizzt looked at Wolfgar and shrugged.
"Fear not, my friend," the barbarian replied, smiling. "There are many more enemies to hit."
With another bellow to his battle god, Wolfgar turned about and charged for the main fight, trying to pick out Brunner's one-horned helmet amidst a writhing sea of tangled goblins and dwarves. Drizzt didn't follow, though, for he preferred single combat to the wildness of general melee. Calling Gwenevar to his side, the drow made his way along the wall, eventually exiting the main chamber. After only a few steps and a warning growl from his trusted panther ally, he came to realize that Regis wasn't far behind. Brunner's estimates of the dwarven prowess seemed on target as the battle soon became a rout. In trading hits with the armored dwarves, the goblins found their crude swords and puny clubs to be no match against the tempered weapons of their enemies. Brunner's people, too, were better trained, holding tight formations and keeping their nerves, which was difficult amidst all the chaos and the cries of the dying. Goblins fled by the dozen, most finding the line of Dagna and his charges eagerly waiting to kill them. With all the confusion, Catty Bree had to pick her shots carefully, particularly since she couldn't be certain that a skinny goblin torso would stop her flying arrows. Mostly, the young woman concentrated on those goblins breaking ranks, fleeing into the open ground between the main fight and Dagna's line. For all her talk of parley and all the accusations she had leveled at Brunner and the others, the young woman could not deny the tingle, the adrenaline rush that swept over her every time she lifted Talmaril the Heartseeker. Wolfgar's eyes, too, gleamed with a luster that indicated the fine edge of survival. Raised among a warlike people, he had learned the battle lust at an early age, a rage that had been tempered only when Brunner and Drizzt had taught him the worth of his perceived enemies and the many sorrows his tribe's wars had caused. There was no guilt in this fight, though, not against evil goblins, and Wolfgar's charge from the dead Ettins to the larger battle was accompanied by a hearty song to Tempus. Wolfgar found no target clear enough for him to chance a throw with his hammer, but he was not dismayed, particularly when a group of several goblins broke clear of the fighting and fled his way. The leading three hardly realized that the barbarian was there when Wolfgar's first sidelong cut with Aegis Fang swept them aside, killing two. The goblins behind stumbled in surprise but came on anyway, flowing around the barbarian like a river around a rock. A goblin head exploded under Aegis Fang's next heavy blow. Wolfgar snapped the hammer across one-handed to deflect a sword, then followed with a punching left hook that shattered his would-be attacker's jaw and sent the creature flying. The barbarian felt a sting in his side, and he flinched before the sword could dig in deeply. His free hand whipped back across, clamping atop his attacker's head and lifting the squirming creature from the ground. It still had its sword, and Wolfgar realized that he was vulnerable. He found his only possible defense in sheer savagery, jerking the lifted goblin back and forth so violently that the creature could not get its bearings for a strike. Wulfgar spun around to drive his many attackers back, using his momentum to aid in his one-handed hammer swipe. An advancing goblin tried to backtrack and lifted its arm in a pitiful defense, but the warhammer blasted through the skinny limb and crushed on, knocking the creature's head so powerfully that when the goblin fell to the ground, it landed on its back. Its face, too, was squarely against the stone. The stubborn, stupid goblin in the air nicked Wulfgar's huge biceps. The barbarian brought the creature down hard, squeezed and twisted, and heard the satisfying crack of neck bone. Seeing a coming charge from the corner of his eye, he hurled the dead thing at its companions, scattering them. "Tempus!" the barbarian roared. He took up his warhammer in both hands and rushed into the bulk of the surrounding group, whipping Aegis Fang back and forth repeatedly. Any goblin that could not flee that furious charge, could not get out of deadly range, found a piece of its body utterly destroyed. Wulfgar pivoted and came back at the group he knew was behind him. The goblins had indeed begun in advance, but when the mighty warrior spun about, his face contorted in wild-eyed frenzy, the goblins turned about and ran away. Wulfgar heaved his hammer, crushing one, then pivoted again and rushed back the other way at the other group. These two fled, apparently not caring that the wild human was unarmed. Wulfgar caught one of them by the elbow, spun it about to face him, and clamped his other hand over its face, bending it over backward to the ground. Aegis Fang reappeared in his hand, and the barbarian's fury doubled. Brunner had to plant a boot solidly to free his many-notched axe from the chest of his latest victim. When the blade pulled free, a burst of blood followed it, showering the dwarf. Brunner didn't care, sure that the goblins were evil things, that the results of his savage attacks bettered the world. Smiling with abandon, the dwarf king darted this way and that in the tight press, finally finding another target. The goblin swung first, its club smashing apart when it connected with Brunner's fine shield. The stupid goblin stared at its broken weapon in disbelief, then looked at the dwarf just in time to see the axe dive between its eyes. A flash cut right by the dwarf, frightening the pleasure from him. He realized it was Catibree's doing, though, and saw the victim a dozen feet away, pinned to the stone floor by the quivering, silver-shafted arrow.
"Damn good bow,"
the dwarf muttered. And in looking back to his daughter, he noticed a goblin scrambling up onto the platform.
"No, ye don't," the dwarf cried,
rushing to the slab and diving into a roll atop it. He came up beside the creature, ready to exchange blows, when another flash forced him to jump back. The goblin still stood, looking down to its chest as though it expected to find an arrow sticking there. It found a hole instead, right through both lungs. The goblin poked a finger in a ridiculous attempt to stem the blood flow. Then it fell dead. Brunner planted his hands on his hips and stared hard at his daughter.
"Hey, girl," he scolded, "you're stealing all me fun!"
Catibree's fingers began to pull on her bowstring, but she relaxed it immediately. Brunner considered the woman's curious action, then understood, as a goblin club connected heavily with the back of his head.
"I left that one for yourself,"
Catibree said with a shrug, a lame movement when weighed against the glower of Brunner's dark eyes. Brunner wasn't listening. He threw his shield up, blocking the next predictable attack, and whirled, his axe leading the way. The goblin sucked in its belly and hopped back to its tiptoes.
"Not far enough," the dwarf told it, politely using its own tongue,
and his words were proven true as the goblin's guts spilled out. The horrified creature regarded them in disbelief.
"Ye shouldn't be hitting me when I'm not looking,"
was all the apology it would get from Brunner Battlehammer, and his second swipe, angled into the goblin's neck, took the creature's head from its shoulders. With the platform clear of enemies, both Brunner and Catibree turned to regard the general battle. Catibree brought her bow up, but then didn't see the point of releasing any more arrows. Most of the goblins were in flight, but with Dagna's troops lined across the chamber, they had nowhere to go. Brunner leaped down and put his forces into an organized pursuit, and like a great snapping maw, the dwarven hosts closed over the goblin horde. Chapter 4 Dwarven Toy. Drizzt slipped down a quiet passageway, the clamor of the wild battle lost behind him. The drow was not worried. for he knew that his shadow, his Guinevere, was padding along silently, not too far ahead. Of more concern to Drizzt was Regis, still stubbornly close to his back. Fortunately, the halfling moved as silently as the drow, keeping equally well to the shadows, and did not seem to be a liability to Drizzt. The need for silence was the only thing that kept Drizzt from questioning the halfling then and there, for if they stumbled on a number of goblins, Drizzt did not know how Regis, who was not skilled in battle, would keep out of harm's way. Ahead, the black panther paused and looked back at Drizzt. The cat, darker than the darkness, then slipped through an opening and moved to the side into a chamber. Beyond the opening, Drizzt heard the unmistakable snarling voices of goblins. Drizzt looked back to Regis, to the red dots that showed the halfling's heat-sensing infravision. Halflings, too, could see in the dark, but not nearly as well as drow or goblins. Drizzt held one hand up, motioned for Regis to wait in the corridor, then slipped ahead to the entrance. The goblins, at least six or seven, were huddled near the center of the small chamber, milling about many natural, tooth-like pillars. To the right, along the wall, Drizzt sensed a slight movement and knew it was Guinevere, patiently waiting for him to make the first move. How wondrous a fighting companion that panther was, Drizzt reminded himself. Always, Guinevere let Drizzt determine the course of battle, then discerned the best way to fit in. The drow ranger moved to the nearest stalagmite, belly crawled to another, and rolled behind yet another, ever closer to his prey. He made out nine goblins now, apparently discussing their best course of action. They had no guard posted, had no clue that danger was near. One rolled around to put its back against a stalagmite, separated from the others by a mere 5 feet. A scimitar sliced up through its belly, into its lungs, before it could utter a sound. Eight remained. Drizzt eased the corpse to the ground and took its place, putting his back to the stone. A moment later, one of the goblins called to him, thinking he was the dead goblin. Drizzt grunted in reply. A hand reached around to pat his shoulder, and the drow couldn't hide his smile. The goblin tapped him once, then again, more slowly. Then the thing began feeling around the drow's thick cloak, apparently noticing Drizzt's taller stature. A curious expression on its ugly face, the goblin peeked around the mound. Then there were seven, and Drizzt leaped out into their midst, scimitars flashing in a flurry that took the two nearest goblins down in the blink of an eye. The remaining five shrieked and ran about, some colliding with stalagmites, others slapping and falling all over each other. A goblin came straight for Drizzt, its mouth flapping a steady stream of undiscernible words, and its hands held wide as though in a gesture of friendship. Apparently, the evil creature only then recognized this dark elf was no potential comrade, for it began to frantically back away. Drizzt's scimitars crossed in a downward slash, drawing an X of hot blood on the creature's chest. Guinevere streaked beside the drow and attacked a goblin fleeing toward the far side of the cavern. With a single swipe of the panther's huge claw, the count was down to three. Finally, two goblins regained their senses enough to come at the drow in a coordinated fashion, weapons drawn. One launched its club in a roundhouse swing, but Drizzt slapped the weapon wide before it ever got close. His scimitar, the same he had used to deflect the blow, darted left, then right and right, and again a third time, leaving the stunned creature with six mortal wounds. It stared dumbfounded as it fell backward to the floor. All the while, Drizzt's second scimitar easily parried the other goblin's many desperate attacks. When the drow turned to face this creature fully, it knew it was doomed. It hurled its short sword at Drizzt, again with little effect, and darted behind the nearest stone pillar. The last of the confused creatures crossed behind it, startling the drow and securing the other's escape. Drizzt cursed the goblin's apparent luck. He wanted none to get away, but these two were, either wisely or fortunately, fleeing in opposite directions. A split second later, though, the drow heard a resounding crack from behind the pillar, and the goblin that had thrown its short sword toppled back out from behind the mound, its skull shattered. Regis, holding his little mace, peeked around the pillar and shrugged. Drizzt was at a loss and simply returned the stare, then spun about to pursue the remaining goblin, which was fast weaving its way around the cavern teeth toward a corridor at the chamber's far end. The drow, faster and more agile, gained steadily. He noticed Guinevere, the panther's maw glowing hot with the blood of a fresh kill, loping along a parallel course and gaining on the goblin with every long stride. Drizzt was confident then that the creature had no chance of escape. At the corridor's entrance, the goblin jolted to a stop. Drizzt skidded aside, as did Guinevere, both diving for the cover of pillars, as a series of snapping and sparking explosions ignited all about the goblin's body. It shrieked and jerked wildly, this way and that, pieces of its clothing and its flesh blew away. The continuing explosions held the goblin up long after it was dead. Finally, they ended, and the creature fell to the floor, trailing thin lines of smoke from several dozen blasted wounds. Drizzt and Guinevere held steady, perfectly silent, not knowing what new monster had arrived. The chamber lit up suddenly with a magical light. Drizzt, fighting hard to bring his eyes into focus, clutched his scimitars tightly.
"All dead?" he heard a familiar dwarven voice say.
He blinked his eyes open just in time to see the cleric Cobble enter the room, one hand in a large belt pouch, the other holding a shield out before him. Several soldiers came in behind, one of them muttering,
"Damn good spell, priest!"
Cobble moved to inspect the shattered body, then nodded his agreement. Drizzt slipped out from behind the mound. The surprised cleric's hand came whipping out, launching a score of small objects. Pebbles? At the drow. Guinevere growled, Drizzt dove, and the pebbles hit the rock where he had been standing, initiating another burst of small explosions.
"Drizzt!" Cobble cried, realizing his mistake. "Drizzt!"
He rushed to the drow, who was looking back to the many scorch marks on the floor.
"Are you all right, dear Drizzt?"
Cobble cried.
"Damn good spell, priest!"
Drizzt replied, in his best imitation dwarf voice, his smile wide and admiring. Cobble clapped him hard on the back, nearly knocking him over.
"I like that one too," he said,
showing Drizzt that he had a pouch full of the bomb-like pebbles.
"Ye want to carry some?"
"I do,"
replied Regis, coming around a stalagmite, closer to the tunnel entrance than Drizzt had been. Drizzt blinked his lavender orbs in amazement at the halfling's prowess. Another force of goblins, more than 100 strong, had been positioned in corridors to the right of the main chamber, to come in at the flank after the fighting had begun. With the trap's failure and Brunner's ensuing charge, led by the horrible silver-streaking arrows, the Etin's forces' miserable failure, and Dagna's dwarven troops' subsequent arrival, even the stupid goblins had been wise enough to turn the other way and run.
"Dwarveses!"
one of the front-running goblins cried out, and the others soon echoed him in calls that shifted from terror to hunger when the creatures came to believe they had stumbled on a small band of the bearded folk, perhaps a scouting party. Whatever the case, these dwarves apparently had no intention of stopping to fight, and the chase was on. A few twists and turns put the fleeing dwarves and the goblins near a wide, smoothly worked torchlit tunnel, one that had been cut by the dwarves of Mithril Hall several hundred years before. For the first time since that long-ago day, the dwarves were there again, waiting. Powerful dwarven hands eased great disks onto a wooden beam, one after another, until the whole resembled a solid, cylindrical wheel as tall as a dwarf and nearly as wide as the worked corridor, weighing well over a ton. Completing the structure's main frame were a few well-placed pegs, a wrapping of sheet metal with sharp, nasty ridges hammered into it, and two notched handles that ran from the wheel's side to behind the contraption, where dwarves could man them and push the thing along. A cloth with the full-sized likenesses of charging dwarves painted on it was hung out in front as a finishing touch that would keep the goblins in line until it was too late to retreat.
"Here they come!" one of the forward scouts reported, returning to the main battle group. "They'll turn the corner in a few minutes. Are the baiters ready?"
asked the dwarf in charge of the toy brigade. The other dwarf nodded, and the haulers took up the poles, setting their hands firmly behind the appropriate notches. Four soldiers got out in front of the contraption, ready for their wild run, while the rest of the 100 dwarf contingent fell into lines behind the haulers.
"The cubbies are 100 feet down," the boss dwarf reminded the lead soldiers. "Don't ye miss the mark! Once we get this thing a-rolling, we're not likely to be stopping it."
Feigned cries of fear came from the fleeing dwarves at the other end of the long corridor, followed by the whooping of the pursuing goblins. The boss dwarf shook his bearded face. It was too easy to bait goblins. Just let them believe they had the upper hand, and on they'd come. The lead soldiers began a slow trot, the haulers behind them took up the easy pace, and the army plodded along behind the thunder of the slow-rolling wheel. Another series of shouts sounded, and mixed in was the unmistakable cry of,
"No!"
The lead soldiers roared and broke into a run. The massive toy came right behind, pumping dwarven legs, setting the devilish wheel into a great roll. Above the thunder, the dwarves began their growling song.
"Tunnels too tight! Tunnels too low! Better run, goblin, 'cause here we go!"
Their charge sounded like an avalanche, rumbling undertones to the goblins' cries. The baiters waved to their approaching kin, then stopped beside the cubbies and turned to hurl insults at their goblin pursuers. The boss dwarf smiled grimly at the knowledge that he, that the toy, would pass the small alcoves, the only safe places in front of the contraption, a split second before the goblin hosts arrived there. Just as the dwarves had planned. With no way to turn back, thinking that they had encountered a simple dwarven expedition, the long lines of goblins hooted their battle cries and continued their charge. The leading dwarven soldiers joined the baiters. Together they dove aside into the alcoves, and the toy rumbled by, its disguising canopy making the front goblins slow their pace in wonder. Howls of terror replaced battle cries and echoed down the goblin line. The closest goblin bravely hacked at the bouncing dwarven image, taking the painted canopy down and revealing the disaster an instant before the creature was squashed. The fearsome dwarves called their war toy the Juicer, and the puddle of goblin fluid that came out the backside of the crushing wheel showed it was a fitting title.
"Sing, my dwarves!"
commanded the boss, and they took their chant to great crescendos, their rumbling voices echoing above the goblin howls.
"Every bump's a goblin's head, pools of blood from the goblin dead. Run, good dwarves, push that toy, squish the little goblin boys."
The brutal contraption bounced and bumped. The haulers stumbled on goblin piles. But if any dwarf fell away, a dozen more were ready to take up his part of the pole, powerful legs pumping feverishly. The army behind the contraption began to stretch out, dwarves stopping to finish off those broken goblins that still squirmed. The main host stayed close to the bouncing contraption, though, for as it came farther along the tunnel, it began to pass side tunnels. Predetermined brigades of dwarven soldiers turned down these, right behind the passing toy, slaughtering any goblins still in the area.
"Tight turn!"
the boss dwarf yelled, and sparks flew from the side of the steel-covered outer stone wheels as they screeched along. The dwarves had counted on this region to stop the rolling monstrosity. It didn't. And around the bend loomed the end of the corridor, a dozen goblins scratching at the unyielding stone, trying to find escape.
"Let it go!" cried the boss,
and the wild rushing dwarves did, falling all over each other as they continued to bounce along. With a tremendous explosion that shook the bedrock, the juicer collided with the wall. It wasn't hard for the cheering dwarves to figure out what had happened to the unfortunate creatures caught in between.
Oh, good work,
the boss dwarf said to his charges as he looked back around the bend to the long line of crushed goblins. The dwarven soldiers were still battling, but now they badly outnumbered their enemies, for more than half the goblin force had been squashed.
Good work,
the boss reiterated heartily, and by a goblin-hating dwarf's estimation, it certainly was. Back in the main chamber, Brunner and Dagna exchanged victorious and wet hugs,
sharing the blood of their enemies, as the brutal dwarves called it.
A few dwarves had been killed and many others lay wounded, but neither of the leaders had dared to hope that the rout would be so complete.
What do you think of that, me girl?
Brunner asked Catti Bree when she came over to join him, her long bow comfortably over one shoulder.
We did as we had to do, the woman replied. And the goblins were, as expected, a treacherous bunch. But I'll not back down on me words. We did right in trying to talk first.
Dagna spat on the floor, but Brunner, the wiser of the two, nodded his agreement with his daughter.
Tempus!
They heard Wulfgar cry in victory, and the barbarian, spotting the group, began bounding over to them, his mighty warhammer held high above his head.
I'm still for thinking that you're all taking a bit too much pleasure in it all,
Catti Bree remarked to Brunner. Apparently not wanting to talk with Wulfgar, she moved away, back to help the wounded.
Bah! Brunner snorted behind her. Sure, and ye set your own bow to some sweet singing.
Catti Bree brushed her auburn locks out of her face and did not look back. She didn't want Brunner to see her smile. The Juicer Brigade entered the main chamber a half hour later, reporting the rear flank clear of goblins. Only a few minutes after them, Drizzt, Regis, and Guinevar came in, the drow telling Brunner that Cobble's forces were finishing up in the corridors to the left and the rear.
Did ye get a few for yourself? The dwarf asked. After the Ettins, I mean.
Drizzt nodded.
I did, he replied. As did Guinevar. And Regis.
Both Drizzt and the dwarf turned curious eyes on the halfling, who stood easily, his bloodied mace in hand. Noticing the looks, Regis slipped the weapon behind his back as though he were embarrassed.
I did not even expect you to come, Rumblebelly, Brunner said to him. I thought ye'd be staying up, helping yourself to more food while the rest of us did all the fighting.
Regis shrugged.
I figured that the safest place in all the world would be beside Drizzt, he explained.
Brunner wasn't about to argue with that logic.
We can set to digging in a few 10 days, he explained to his ranger friend. After some expeditionary miners come through and name the place safe.
By this point, Drizzt was hardly listening to him. He was more interested in the fact that Catti Bree and Wulfgar, moving about the ranks of wounded, obviously were avoiding each other.
It's the boy,
Brunner told him, noticing his interest. He did not think a woman should be at the battle, Drizzt replied.
Bah! Snorted the red-bearded dwarf. She's as fine a fighter as we've got. Besides, 5 dozen dwarf women came along, and 2 of them even got killed.
Drizzt's face twisted with surprise as he regarded the dwarf king. He shook his white shock of hair helplessly and started away to join Catti Bree, but stopped and looked back after only a few steps, shaking his head yet again.
5 dozen of them,
Brunner reiterated into his doubting expression.
Dwarf women, I tell ye.
My friend, Drizzt answered, moving off once more. I never could tell the difference. Cobble's forces joined the other dwarves 2 hours later, reporting the rear areas clear of enemies. The rout was complete, as far as Brunner and his commanders could discern, with not a single enemy left alive. None of the dwarven forces had noticed the slender, dark forms. Dark elves, Jarlaxle's spies, floating among the stalactites near critical areas of battle, watching the dwarven movements and battle techniques with more than passing interest. The goblin threat was ended. But that was the least of Brunner Battlehammer's problems. Chapter 5. Ye of Little Faith. Deenan watched Vierna's every move, watched how his sister went through the precise rituals to honor the Spider Queen. The drow were in a small chapel Jarlaxle had secured for Vierna's use in one of the minor houses of Menzo Berenzon. Deenan remained faithful to the dark deity Lolf, and willingly had agreed to accompany Vierna to her prayers this day. But in truth, the male drow thought the whole thing a senseless facade, thought his sister a ridiculous mockery of her former self.
"You should not be so doubting,"
Vierna remarked to him, still going about her ritual and not bothering to look over her shoulder to regard Deenan. At the sound of Deenan's disgusted sigh, though, Vierna did spin about, an angry red glower in her narrow-set eyes.
"What is the purpose?"
Deenan demanded, facing her wrath bravely. Even if she was out of Lolf's favor, as Deenan stubbornly believed, Vierna was larger and stronger than he, and armed with some clerical magic. He gritted his teeth, firmed his resolve, and did not back down, fearful that Vierna's mounting obsession again would lead those around him down a path to destruction. In answer, Vierna produced a curious whip from under the folds of her clerical robes. While its handle was unremarkable black adamantite, the instrument's five tendrils were writhing, living snakes. Deenan's eyes widened. He understood the weapon's significance.
"Lolf does not allow any but her high priestesses to wield these," Vierna reminded him, affectionately petting the heads.
"But we lost favor," Deenan started to protest, but it was a lame argument in the face of Vierna's demonstration.
Vierna eyed him and laughed evilly, almost purred, as she bent to kiss one of the heads.
"Then why go after Drizzt?" Deenan asked her. "You have regained the favor of Lolf. Why risk everything chasing our traitorous brother?"
"That is how I regained the favor,"
Vierna screamed at him. She advanced a step, and Deenan wisely backed away. He remembered his younger days at House Doerten, when Brisa, his oldest and most vicious sister, often tortured him with one of those dreaded snake-headed whips. Vierna calmed immediately, though, and looked back to her dark, both live and sculpted, spider-covered altar.
"Our family fell because of Matron Malice's weakness," she explained. "Malice failed in the most important task Lolf ever gave her."
"To kill Drizzt," Deenan reasoned.
"Yes,"
Vierna said simply, looking back over her shoulder to regard her brother.
"To kill Drizzt. Wretched, traitorous Drizzt. I have promised his heart to Lolf, have promised to right the family's wrong, so that we, you and I, might regain the favor of our goddess."
"To what end?"
Deenan had to ask, looking around the unremarkable chapel with obvious scorn.
"Our house is no more. The name of Doerden cannot be spoken anywhere in the city. What will be the gain if we again find Lolf's favor? You will be a high priestess, and for that I am glad, but you will have no house over which to preside."
"But I will,"
Vierna retorted, her eyes flashing.
"I am a surviving noble of a destroyed house, as are you, my brother. We have all the rights of accusation."
Deenan's eyes went wide. Vierna was technically correct. The rights of accusation was a privilege reserved for surviving noble children of destroyed houses, wherein the children named their attackers and thus brought the weight of drow justice upon the guilty party. In the continuing backroom intrigue of chaotic Menzo Berenzon, though, justice was selectively meted out.
"Accusation?"
Deenan stammered, barely able to get the word out of his suddenly dry mouth.
"Have you forgotten which house it was that destroyed our own?"
"It is all the sweeter,"
purred his stubborn sister.
"Beyenri!"
Deenan cried.
"House Beyenri, first house of Menzo Berenzon. You cannot speak against Beyenri. No house, alone or in alliance, will move against them. And Matron Beyenri controls the academy. Where will your force of justice be garnered?" And what of Brake and Eärth? Dinan reminded her. The very band of mercenaries that took us in helped defeat our house.
Dinan stopped abruptly, considering his own words, ever amazed by the paradox, the cruel irony of Drow society.
You are a male, and cannot understand the beauty of love,
Vierna replied.
Our goddess feeds from this chaos, considers this situation all the sweeter simply because of the many furious ironies.
The city will not wage war against House Beenri, Dinan said flatly.
It will never come to that,
Vierna snapped back, and again came that wild flash in her red glowing orbs.
Matron Beenri is old, my brother. Her time has long passed. When Drizzt is dead, as the Spider Queen demands, I will be granted an audience in House Beenri, wherein we will make our accusation.
Then we will be fed to Beenri's goblin slaves, Dinan replied dryly.
Matron Beenri's own daughters will force her out, so that the house might regain the Spider Queen's favor,
the excited Vierna went on, ignoring her doubting brother.
To that end, they will place me in control.
Dinan could hardly find the words to rebut Vierna's preposterous claims.
Think of it, my brother, Vierna went on. Envision yourself standing beside me as I preside over the first house of Menzo Berenzon.
Loth has promised this to you.
Through Triel,
Vierna replied.
Matron Beenri's oldest daughter, herself matron mistress of the academy.
Dinan was beginning to catch on. If Triel, much more powerful than Vierna, meant to replace her admittedly ancient mother, she certainly would claim the throne of House Beenri for herself, or at least allow one of her many worthy sisters to take the seat. Dinan's doubts were obvious as he half sat on one bench, crossing his arms in front of him and shaking his head slowly back and forth.
I have no room for disbelievers in my entourage, Vierna warned.
Your entourage? Dinan replied.
Brake and Eärth is but a tool provided to me so that I might please the goddess,
Vierna explained without hesitation.
You are insane,
Dinan said, before he could find the wisdom to keep the thought to himself. To his relief, though, Vierna did not advance toward him.
You shall regret those sacrilegious words when our traitorous Drizzt is given to Lolf,
the priestess promised.
You'll never get near our brother,
Dinan replied sharply, his memories of his previous disastrous encounter with Drizzt still painfully clear.
And I'll not go along with you to the surface, not against that demon. He is powerful, Vierna, mightier than you can imagine.
Silence!
The word carried magical weight, and Dinan found his next planned protests stuck in his throat.
Mightier?
Vierna scoffed a moment later.
What do you know of power, impotent male?
A wry smile crossed her face, an expression that made Dinan squirm in his seat.
Come with me, doubting Dinan, Vierna bade.
She started for a side door in the small chapel, but Dinan made no move to follow.
Come,
Vierna commanded. And Dinan found his legs moving under him, found himself leaving the single stalagmite mound of the lesser house, then leaving Menzo Berenzon altogether, faithfully following his insane sister's every step. As soon as the two Doerdens walked from view, Jarlaxle lowered the curtain in front of his scrying mirror, dispelling the image of the small chapel. He thought he should speak with Dinan soon, to warn the obstinate fighter of the consequences he might face. Jarlaxle honestly liked Dinan, and knew that the Drow was heading for disaster.
You have baited her well,
the mercenary remarked to the priestess standing beside him, giving her a devious wink with his left eye, the uncovered one this day. The female,
shorter than Jarlaxle, but carrying herself with an undeniable strength, snarled at the mercenary, her contempt obvious. "My dear Triel," Jarlaxle cooed.
"Hold your tongue," Triel Bayenry warned, "or I will tear it out and give it to you, that you might hold it in your hand."
Jarlaxle shrugged, and wisely shifted the conversation back to the business at hand.
"Vierna believes your claim," he remarked. "Vierna is desperate," Triel Bayenry replied.
"She would have gone after Drizzt on the simple promise that you would take her into your family," the mercenary reasoned. "But to bait her with delusions of replacing Matron Bayenry."
"The greater the prize, the greater Vierna's motivation," Triel replied calmly. "It is important to my mother that Drizzt Do'Urden be given to Lolth. Let the fool Do'Urden priestess think what she will."
"Agreed," Jarlaxle said with a nod, as House Bayenry prepared the escort.
"A score and a half will slip out beside the fighters of Bregendyerth," Triel replied. "They are only males," she added derisively, "and expendable."
The first daughter of House Bayenry cocked her head curiously as she continued to regard the wily mercenary.
"You will accompany Vierna personally with your chosen soldiers?" Triel asked. "To coordinate the two groups?"
Jarlaxle clapped his slender hands together. "I am a part of this," he answered firmly.
"To my displeasure,"
the Bayenry daughter snarled. She uttered a single word and, with a flash, disappeared.
"Your mother loves me, dear Triel," Jarlaxle said to the emptiness,
as if the matron mistress of the academy were still beside him.
"I would not miss this," the mercenary continued, thinking out loud.
By Jarlaxle's estimation, the hunt for Drizzt could be only a good thing. He might lose a few soldiers, but they were replaceable. If Drizzt was indeed brought to sacrifice, Lolth would be pleased, Matron Bayenry would be pleased, and Jarlaxle would find a way to be rewarded for his efforts. After all, on a simpler level, Drizzt Do'Urden, as a traitorous renegade, carried a high bounty on his head. Jarlaxle chuckled wickedly, reveling in the beauty of it all. If Drizzt managed somehow to elude them, then Vierna would take the fall, and the mercenary would continue on, untouched by it all. There was another possibility that Jarlaxle, removed from the immediate situation and wise in the ways of the drow, recognized, and if, by some remote chance, it came to pass, he again would be in a position to profit greatly, simply from his favorable relationship with Vierna. Triel had promised Vierna an unbelievable prize because Lolth had instructed her and her mother to do so. What would happen if Vierna fulfilled her part of the agreement, the mercenary wondered. What ironies did conniving Lolth have in store for House Bayenry? Surely, Vierna Do'Urden seemed insane for believing Triel's empty promises, but Jarlaxle knew well that many of Menzo Baranzon's most powerful drow, Matron Bayenry included, had seemed, at one time in their lives, equally crazy. Vierna pressed through the opaque doorway to Jarlaxle's private chambers later that day, her crazed expression revealing the anxiety for the coming events. Jarlaxle heard a commotion in the outer corridor, but Vierna merely continued to smile knowingly. The mercenary rocked back in his comfortable chair, tapping his fingers together in front of him and trying to discern what surprise the Do'Urden priestess